Welcome to the latest edition of our AHDB Horticulture Podcast. Natalie Key, our AHDB KE Manager for Protected Edibles and Mushrooms, recently spoke to Adrian Fox of Theroscience about all things tomato brown rugose fruit virus, including what the virus is, its history since its discovery in 2014, resources available for you to monitor going forward, and the next steps in place to combat further outbreaks. Enjoy.
Hello, I am Natalie Key and I am a Knowledge Exchange Manager for AHDB Horticulture, and I'm involved in the work we've been doing to support the UK tomato and pepper industry in protecting their businesses from tomato brown rugose fruit virus. This work includes provision of information around symptoms, outbreaks of the virus, what to do in the situation of a suspected outbreak, as well as hygiene and biosecurity recommendations, alongside much more. All of this information can be found on the AHDB website. Much of our response to mitigate for this virus in the UK has been shaped, developed, and approved via our tomato brown rugose fruit virus steering group, on which I sit with AHDB colleagues, industry representatives, and associates who work in research and government. It includes Adrian Fox from Theroscience, who we are going to talk to today about the research project we have funded looking into the survival and disinfection of this virus. So hello, Adrian. If you could please give us a quick introduction about your role at Theroscience and involvement with the work on tomato brown rugose fruit virus.
Okay. Hi, Natalie. The senior plant virologist at Theroscience. We're based in York. And we are the National Reference Laboratory for Plant Health Diagnostics in England and Wales. But we also offered diagnostic services to commercial growers, to other governments around the world. And we also provide advice on the pathogens that we find and we deal with. And we're largely concerned with both the quarantine, so the high-risk pathogens in international trade, but also what we call the quality pathogens, so the things that affect growers on a more everyday basis. I lead the virology team there, and as I say, our main function is to provide diagnostic services, but we also provide advice as well. And I sit on the steering group, and I suppose my role is to provide plant virology advice, so that's including advice on the virus itself, the biology, but also how to detect it, what biosecurity measures may help reduce the risk of introduction and spread of the virus. And we've been conducting research to support that advice. And we're looking at the survival of tomato brown rugose fruit virus on skin and on gloves, but also on a range of common glasshouse surfaces. And we're also looking at the efficacy of things like hand washing and trying to determine the efficacy of a range of disinfectant approaches.
Just to bring it back a little bit, clearly this virus is of great concern to the commercial UK tomato and pepper industry, as it has significant potential for economic impact, particularly as it's so easily transmissible. Can you provide a bit of further background on the virus, so such as what type of virus it is, an overview of some of the outbreaks and such?
The virus comes from a genus that we call tabamoviruses, and these viruses are really one of the oldest known plant viruses and some of the first characterized, and then they're related to a virus called tobacco mosaic virus, and they're characterized because they're robust. They can survive for a long time in the environment outside of their host, also in leaf debris, and they're notable because they're contact transmissible. And several members of this genus are notable plant pests of glasshouse crops, such as peppers, tomatoes, and cucumbers. And they're really different viruses from this group cause problems in different crops around the world. Tomato brown rugose fruit virus specifically first emerged in the Middle East in about 2014.
Yeah.
In Jordan. It was then found in Israel, and really within the space of a year, it spread through most of that region. And since then, we've had outbreaks in Mexico and then throughout Europe. So Italy, Germany, UK as of last year, but also France, Spain, the Netherlands. So I think the virus is obviously moving quickly around the world, but also once growers are affected, it can cause some severe issues. And certainly from the information we had from those initial outbreaks in the Middle East and also the outbreaks in Mexico, the issues that growers could see would be quite damaging to their crop and really affect the marketability of the fruit. So, as I said, viruses are characterized by being contact transmissible. But when we think about how viruses are spread, we have to think both in terms of long distance movement and short distance movement. So really the long distance movement, we suspect it's primarily through infected seed. And that's been a major focus of international regulation at the moment. We're doing a lot of testing of seed that have been imported into the UK just to make sure that the virus isn't present on the seed, and where it is present on the seed, it's getting rejected. But on a more local level, once you actually get an outbreak of the virus in a plant, your main issue then would be really contact transmission, and that's your major concern in the glasshouse. So that could be on hands or on clothing, or it could be via sap from routine cutting and handling of plants, or it could be sap from damaged fruit. There are a few other reports of transmission routes. So there's a report of the bumblebee transmission, where bumblebees being used for pollination in glasshouses can pick up the virus on pollen and then move that from plant to plant. And effectively, that's just another form of mechanical contact transmission.
So to come back to the research project we talked about briefly, you mentioned some of the goals of that project, including trying to find out how long the virus survives on different surfaces, and also which disinfectants might work in deactivating the virus and reducing spread. Are there specific results and outcomes so far from this work that growers can apply to their businesses to help protect themselves?
We're starting to get those results through. Because this is a contact transmissible pathogen, as I said, the group of viruses that we're playing with are very robust. You're really coming down to a range of hygiene recommendations. We initially put out hygiene recommendations via the AHDB on the knowledge bank around tomato brown rugose fruit virus. And so some of the work that we're doing and the results that we're getting out are then to feed in and try and improve that advice as we go. So we've looked at survival on skin, gloves and different glasshouse surfaces. And in that, we found that the virus from both sap contamination, but also from just rubbing an infected leaf, the virus will stay active for at least 2 hours. And so from there, we then looked at how effective different hand washing approaches would be. And I think at the present time, given the global pandemic we're in the middle of, people are probably more aware of hand washing than they've ever been. But what we did find was that hand washing for 30 seconds was of limited efficacy. There was one product we trialed that did appear to work if washing for 1 minute, but then a 1 minute hand wash is thought to be impractical and difficult to police. So really what we're advising is that growers wear disposable gloves and change them often whilst working.
And there's differing advice around that, isn't there, in terms of what often means?
Yes, and that's the difficult thing to do when you're sitting in a laboratory, is try and formulate what often means to an individual glasshouse situation. And some of that will really come down to growers looking at their specific situation and doing a risk assessment of different tasks within the glasshouse, and then deciding how often gloves should be changed on that basis. The other thing we've looked at is the survival on surfaces, and also how easy it is to disinfect those different surfaces. So we've taken a range of common glasshouse surfaces, glass, concrete, aluminium, stainless steel, hard plastics, or something like a picking tray, but also polythene. And we found that all were still infectious with the virus after 7 days exposure. And on some surfaces, such as plastics and glass, we've had survival up to 6 months. So we then went to look at disinfection. And it's key to say at this point that with the disinfection approaches, what we've been looking for is the minimum contact time that we could advise growers would give them control of the pathogen. And again, that's really to try and fit in with glasshouse working routines. And the disinfection work's really been a bit of a mixed bag. The issue with this kind of work is that given all the potential permutations of concentration of product and contact time, you can end up with something that's very, very complex to try and work in an experimental way. So what we wanted to look at was exposure for 1 minute and for 1 hour to start with and see whether we got control at those kind of exposures. And it's key to say that all the products we trialled had some efficacy on some surfaces, but in many cases that was a bit inconsistent, and we haven't found the one all-round product that will give you good control on all surfaces. And some surfaces have been far more challenging than others. Concrete appears to be particularly stubborn and resistant to disinfection, and that's across a range of different products.
Can you give any information on which disinfectants work most effectively in spite of that variability?
So within the report that we've got and the information on the website, so as I said, the products we've trialled so far are Menno Florades, Jet 5, Sodium Hypochlorite, Vercon S, Huasan and TSP. The Huasan looks to be effective, as does the Vercon S, on most surfaces. Again, the concrete was a bit stubborn, I think is probably the safest thing to say. Sodium hypochlorite looks to be effective across a range of surfaces, but again, some inconsistent results on things like the glass and the stainless steel.
And also, I guess it's important to note that that was all 1 hour contact time, that when effectiveness was...
Yeah, we didn't find anything that was effective at 1 minute contact time.
So if a grower identifies suspicious symptoms in their crop and suspect an outbreak, obviously they should report it to the relevant authority. Can you give any information on who that is?
Okay, so the relevant authority is the Animal and Plant Health Agency within the UK, or should I say within England and Wales. If you're north of the border, that would be the Scottish Government Plant Health Inspectors. And you can get details of all the relevant organisations in different parts of Great Britain and Northern Ireland that you should contact should you suspect an outbreak. As I said, because of the devolved nature of plant health within the UK, there are multiple different agencies, but we've listed them all on the HDB website for people to refer to.
And moving on from that, should growers regularly be testing their crop to monitor for this virus? So do you have any recommendations about how best for them to do that?
Okay. I think the most important thing is symptom awareness. Whilst most of the information we have on symptom development comes from much warmer climates and different growing systems to the ones we have, and it does appear that there may be some very mild or relatively asymptomatic infections within our, what you might call, northern hemisphere lit crop type growing systems. I think being aware of the symptoms you may see is really key, and don't just dismiss symptoms as being something like plant stress or other things that you may see in the glasshouse. And if you do see something, get it checked. And we have pictures of symptoms on the HDB website. The other place you can find pictures of symptoms is on the European Plant Protection Organization website. And those should give you an idea of the kind of thing you may be looking at. There are a number of different test methods available, and all of these have their own pros and cons. You have something like ELISA, which we've heard of recently being called the antibody test. That's one of the cheaper methods that's available. However, with this particular virus, it's prone to cross-contamination, which can lead to a lot of additional testing, because if you've got other closely related viruses, viruses in there, it can give you a false positive. The other methods that are available are molecular based, so they look for the genomic sequence of the virus rather than the presence of the viral antigens. And with this genomic sequence, you get a more specific test and a more sensitive test. So really, you want to be looking for a diagnostic service provider that is offering those molecular tests. And those molecular tests are the ones that are currently being recommended at an international level.
I'll go back quickly to the research project again. Could you talk about briefly the results from testing done on the efficacy of treating surfaces such as trays with hot water, and what that could mean in relation to the efficacy of steaming that some growers might be using?
So the other thing we looked at in terms of disinfection of surfaces was the effectiveness of heat to disinfect. And to do this, we used a hot water treatment. So we looked at 5-minute exposure at 70 degrees and at 90 degrees. And at 70 degrees, we didn't get control of the virus, but at 90 degrees, we showed that a hot water treatment for 5 minutes exposure time did actually denature the virus. And I know some growers are using a steaming approach, and there is a question about whether that kind of hot water immersion effectively mimics what may happen if you were to steam trays. But I think you're looking at a wet heat, so you're still going to get exposure of the virus to heat, and that's going to be the key thing. Even going back to some of the original work that was done on things like tobacco mosaic virus, we know that heating to those kind of temperatures for about 10 minutes will give you control of the virus and actually denature the virus.
What do you think at the moment are the necessary next steps for research and development of knowledge around this virus, you know, in terms of what the gaps are at the moment to help growers, you know, manage and protect themselves from the virus?
Okay, I think it's key to look at more disinfection treatments. So there are other products we still haven't trialled. There's a question about contact times, concentrations, and so on. And one thing I'd also like to potentially look at is, once we find a treatment, is to look at the efficacy of that on seed. But again, that's quite a complex experiment, and you're usually dealing with very low levels of virus, and it becomes quite difficult to do the demonstration of transmission that we'd normally do to show that you have live virus. The other thing I think that would be really useful is to look at the diagnostics themselves and see how we can further apply that. So one question that you've already asked is around growers testing, and certainly in asymptomatic crops, there's still a question mark about the best testing methods to use. And I don't mean that in terms of which diagnostic methods, but just in terms of how best to sample a crop to make sure that you're getting the best coverage across that crop. And that obviously may change at different points after infection and at different times in the growth cycle. And the other thing I'd personally like to look at is to look at what you might call non-invasive monitoring systems. So rather than having people go through a crop and risking further contact transmission through that crop if you have got an infection, is can we use slightly more oblique ways of monitoring the crop? So one thing we've started to, it's a really bad pun, but we've started to dip our toe in the water, is to look at irrigation systems and see whether we can look at testing irrigation water as a way of detecting the virus, but that's very early days in that work. And one other thing that's been mentioned is, say, looking at the entrances to the bee boxes. So could we swab those and see if we could pick up the virus? But again, we haven't actually tried that yet. It's just ideas that have been bounced around as potential routes that we could take for less invasive early warning systems for monitoring crops. it's important to say that we are keeping a watchful eye on what's happening around the world. There's some interesting work come out from the Israeli research team recently, which suggests that if you've got intact fruit, that poses very little risk. It's where you've got damaged fruit that you've got a high transmission risk to plants. And so we're keeping abreast of all of this information and trying to drag it all together to give better information for UK growers. And the real key is just be aware of what you're looking at and don't dismiss symptoms if you see them.
Thank you for listening. We hope you found it useful. To discover more about tomato brown rugose fruit borers, including more about its history, symptoms, best practice, and a host of resources, visit www.hdb.org.uk/knowledge-library/tomato-brown-rugose-fruit-virus. To access our most recent horticulture-related podcast, as well as our cross-sector options, visit www.hdb.org.uk/podcast.